The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be back with you. On today's program, we're going to be finishing our Theodore Roosevelt study. It has a very positive ending, which after we get through some of the news items today, you'll be happy to finish the show on a very positive note. We're living in a very dark, dark world. So many problems, so much evil, so much sickness, so many lies and deception. So hang on to the end, and we'll finish off with our TR study. Well, there's more footage of the George Floyd incident from back on Memorial Day, I think it was. Already, time flies. We're past the summer, practically. Well, I guess right at the tail end of it. In any event, the Daily Mail released this new video. I guess it was one of the cameras on the one of the officers. And the video certainly doesn't show any justification for Mr. Floyd's death, but it does yet again expose media malpractice. It's yet another case where the media are failing to inform the public. They're failing to give the facts, to provide perspective, to give context. We've been spending quite a lot of time on the subject of history during the summer educational program, all through this summer, really. And I'll just remind you of this quote from my father's booklet, the Ezekiel, or Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. And it talks about how much Satan hates history and how much he wants to blot it out. And of course, we've talked about his efforts to blot out our nations, to blot out Israel. This is from the booklet. It says, he has been quite successful in these endeavors, just deleting history, that is. And then my father makes this point. When you forget your history, you lose your perspective, and you don't know what's happening. If you're lost in the present, you can never cope with Satan's deceptions. And so we see it in the broad sweep of events. Satan wanting to delete the perspective, the context. And then with respect to media coverage of events that are happening daily, everything is just carefully selected, carefully framed, carefully edited, and it happens over and over again. You look at some of the extended footage taken from this officer, and you see right away that there's something that's obviously wrong with George Floyd. Either he was high on drugs or was under some kind of demon possession. Maybe it was both. He kept saying over and again, don't shoot me. Don't shoot me. He promised to do everything that the police said. And yet he resisted against the arrest. They had a hard time getting him into the car. He kept saying he was claustrophobic, even though they approached him when he was inside of his own car after the incident with the fake bill and whatever else he had on him at the time. But then when they arrested him and they tried to put him in the police vehicle, he struggled against it, repeatedly saying that I'm claustrophobic. And the other thing that you see from this video is that he was saying, I can't breathe, long before he was on the ground with the knee to the back of his neck. He was saying this even as he refused to be put into the police car. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. He even made the comment that he was probably going to die. Just a strange incident. And the other thing I think that the early video footage shows is that the officers, they didn't come in with this, hey, let's get him. Hey, let's kill this guy. Do you think if they would have said something like that early on in the footage, that that footage would have been covered up for this long. I think it would have leaked a lot earlier. But there's lots of people in the media that have seen this video footage, and they haven't. They haven't leaked it like it happened, I guess, at the Daily Mail. So like I say, what they cover, what they don't cover, it all has to fit carefully within the narrative that they've constructed toward the end of the incident, the officers kept him on the ground for those long minutes. And of course, that's the part that everyone in the world has seen. That's the horrific footage that everyone observed. But when you get into a courtroom, of course, all the members of the jury, they're going to be looking at every single second, every single minute of all of the footage from every angle. And they're going to see the resistance, and they're going to see the refusal to cooperate. Again, none of this, as I say, justifies this man's death. But as I brought out on a program not that long ago, was it second-degree murder? Was the prosecutor, did the prosecutor go for a home run here based upon the public outrage? And then what happens? What happens if something goes wrong in court? This could be yet another setup from the devil to cause more rioting, more violence, more hatred, more division. And that's what we have to keep looking at here, Ephesians 6, and what we're actually wrestling against. We're not wrestling against flesh and blood. It's not a matter of this race versus that race. It's Satan, of course, whipping up the hatred and the racism and the violence and the division and the rioting and the protesting and the violence in the streets. But there's a spirit world behind all of this. And he really does. He's the prince of the power of the air. He is surcharging the air with his attitudes. And so you can be sure that Satan, you can be sure that he is carefully framing all of this. He knows just what to blot out. He knows just what to emphasize. He knows what gets people riled up. And look, we're hardly experts when it comes to, you know, how a law proceeding's going to play out. But what if there's a hung jury? Or even worse than that, what if it's an acquittal? It could happen. You just don't know. You don't know for sure. But what we do know, as I said at the top of the segment, here again, the media, they fail. Here again, the media, they get an F. They're not telling the whole story. And even the footage that they now are showing, now that the Daily Mail has leaked it, even many news sources are, again, just carefully playing certain parts of it. You can't expect to get the full story, that's for sure. There was a pretty long feature in the New York Times. And, of course, with the New York Times, it's hit or miss. Sometimes there's a pretty good in-depth coverage of a subject, like what I'm about to get into here. And then other times, it's just so predictable. It fits right within the agenda. In fact, Sam was going through this article this morning, even as I emailed him the top three stories from the New York Times front page. And basically, it's, you know, President Trump's going rogue. He's going to bypass Congress because they won't get the relief package going. So he's going to do it himself. And that just confirms everything that we've ever known about President Trump. He's an authoritarian. He's a dictator. The second story is about a Trump company that's supposedly guilty of fraud. So some kind of fraudulent activity going on in a Trump company of some kind. And then there was another story on the front page about this trucking company that was bailed out because of its close ties to the White House. So all three stories are about corruption in the Trump White House. And yet, here's this story. It's from August the 3rd. And it says here, the biggest monster is spreading, and it's not coronavirus. So what are they getting at here? at the New York Times. The subhead says, tuberculosis kills 1.5 million people each year. Lockdowns and supply chain disruptions threaten progress against the disease, as well as HIV and malaria. Now, tuberculosis is an infectious disease. Just think about this for a moment. The New York Times, and we noted this a few months ago, the WHO has pointed this out as well. As corrupt as that organization is, they do give some good statistics occasionally. But every year, 1.5 million people are dying of tuberculosis. And that's an infectious disease. It spreads, in other words. And every year, in case you haven't noticed, there's never been a shutdown, right? There's never been a total lockdown. Kills 1.5 million per year. We noted this back in some of our programs in March. This is a clip from the WHO Director General, Dr. Tedros. We played this back, I believe, on March 25th. But here's what the WHO Director said on March 23rd, clip two.
So I would like to end by reminding everyone that although COVID-19 is dominating the world's attention, there is another respiratory disease that's both preventable and treatable, but which kills 1.5 million people every year. And that disease is the old-timer tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, says the WHO director. Now, you go through this New York Times piece, the biggest monster, as it says, and it says here, this insidious disease has touched every part of the globe. It's tuberculosis, the biggest infectious disease killer worldwide, claiming 1.5 million lives each year. It says, until this year, listen to this, until this year, TB and its deadly allies, HIV and malaria, were on the run. The toll from each disease over the previous decade was at its nadir in 2018, the last year for which data are available. Yet now, as the coronavirus pandemic spreads around the world, consuming global health resources, these perennially neglected adversaries are making a comeback. They are making a comeback. The whole focus is on COVID-19. And so what about all of these other diseases? This is the world system. They have to treat these diseases. They have to treat all of these, well, not just even the infectious diseases. They have to treat things like cancer, particularly in the West, heart disease, diabetes, and so on. And like we were saying back in March and April, what happens if everyone's hunkered down and you're afraid to go into a hospital? How many other things are going untreated? Things that should be treated. Now, as I was discussing with Sam, it's like the New York Times prints these in-depth pieces and then quietly goes with it. They're not featured on the front page. You can be sure of that. But it's like they're printing a little bit of the truth, knowing that when the historical account is told later, they can then say, well, you know, we did talk about this. We did write about it. We did warn about it. But it's not going to be on the front page. It's not going to be featured on the nightly news this evening. Even though all of the TV stations, they take the New York Times. That's their script for the evening shows. But this is going to be one that doesn't get much coverage at all. Or if it does, they'll somehow trace it back to all the problems that President Trump has created. As I say, you look at the front page of the New York Times today, and it's all Trump. All things Trump. It says here, it's not just that the coronavirus has diverted scientific attention from TB, HIV, and malaria. The lockdowns, particularly across parts of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, have raised insurmountable barriers to patients who must travel to obtain diagnoses or drugs, according to interviews with more than 24 public health officials. Now, we had a program earlier this year about just the problem of some nations, like in India, for example, where when they put in place the lockdown, there were food shortages right away as people were making a run on stores and things because they didn't have enough to eat. And everyone was supposed to stay locked down, to stay indoors, to stay in the house. Listen to this. It says, in India, home to about 27% of the world's TB cases, diagnoses have dropped by nearly 75% since the pandemic began. In Russia, HIV clinics have been repurposed for coronavirus testing. It says malaria season has begun in West Africa, which has about 90% of malaria deaths in the world. But the normal strategies for prevention, distribution of insecticide-treated bed nets, and spraying with pesticides have been curtailed because of lockdowns. And so malaria, no doubt, is going to spread across West Africa because they haven't been able to do the normal yearly practices of prevention, all because of corona, all because of the Wuhan flu, all because of the lockdowns brought on not by the disease. This has been brought on by governments all over the world. It says, according to one estimate, a three-month lockdown across different parts of the world and a gradual return to normal over 10 months could result in an additional 6.3 million cases of tuberculosis and 1.4 million deaths from it. Now, that's at the New York Times. Maybe the model's off. They certainly had the models wrong with respect to the flu, the Wuhan flu. But that's at the New York Times. Building on stats, I guess, from the WHO. 1.4 million deaths from tuberculosis. In addition to what we generally have, it says a six-month disruption of antiretroviral therapy. I'm not a doctor. It may lead to more than 500,000 additional deaths from illnesses related to HIV, according to the WHO. It says another model by the WHO predicted that in the worst-case scenario, deaths from malaria could double to 770,000 per year. So again, maybe the models are way off. Maybe the projection is just way, way off. But throughout the article, you don't hear or see or read anything about, was it really wise to put in place the lockdown? There's a story in the same New York Times that says, you know what, when the curve was flattened in Israel and they sent the children back to school, boy, that was a disaster. And the obvious message there is that don't you dare send those American children back to school. It's too dangerous. And so you have all of these kinds of contradictions throughout, but not once do you see someone that would have the courage to say, we got it wrong with a total lockdown. It's causing so many other problems. Remember what we said early on. You can go back to those programs in March and April. The cure is worse than the disease. The cure is worse. It's causing more problems. It says several public health experts, some close to tears, warned that if current trends continue, the coronavirus is likely to set back years, perhaps decades, of painstaking progress against TB, HIV, and malaria. Pretty sad if that happens. It really does demonstrate that there is no hope in man. There is no hope in man's system, whether it's the system of medicine or education or whatever it is, government certainly. There is no hope in man. Jeremiah 17. You look at what God saw when he looked down at that society before the flood. The earth just filled with violence and minds on evil continually. We just brought it all on ourselves. That's really the truth of that history. You could say, well, God sent the flood. But he did it as an act of mercy, in fact. Our sins, that's what we want to look at. And we need some context to be able to do that. We need to look at history. We need to consider our mistakes. We don't want to lose perspective. Otherwise, we're not going to understand what's happening. It says, each person with tuberculosis can spread the disease to another 15 individuals over a year, sharply raising the possibility of people infected while indoors, spreading it among their communities once lockdowns end. And so it's not just COVID-19. You could talk about a second, maybe a third wave of that. But there are other diseases. And there are other diseases much worse, as I noted yesterday on the program, worse than COVID-19. Tuberculosis is one of them. Not even talked about. It says TB is the biggest monster of them all. If we're talking about deaths and pandemics, 10 million cases a year, that's quoting from some medical expert. And it says here, according to the WHO, at least 121 countries have reported a drop in TB patients visiting clinics since the pandemic began, threatening hard-fought gains. In other words, you need to catch this disease early on if you're going to have a chance at fighting against it, if you're going to have a chance at keeping it from spreading. But because people are staying home, because they're not going into the hospitals, well, it spreads. It spreads. And yet you're not going to hear anything about it today, at least not in the United States. You can look at the front page of the New York Times and see what's going to lead the way. All things Trump. The Atlantic has an article, Why the Pandemic is So Bad in America. Why is it so bad in America? How did it come to this? A virus 1,000 times smaller than a dust mote has humbled and humiliated the planet's most powerful nation. The whole tone of this article, by the way, they're cheering for the virus. They want the virus to win. They want the virus to bring down the United States. The spirit behind it is blot out Israel. Here's the Atlantic. America's lost its status as a global leader. It's careened between inaction and ineptitude. Of course, the problem all behind it is Donald Trump. He's the cause. It says the breadth and magnitude of its errors are difficult in the moment to truly fathom. You think they're going to pin the blame on Dr. Fauci or any of the experts? Of course not. You think they're going to go back to what Fauci said in February about masks? February or March? You think they're going to go back to January and February to see what Fauci had to say about travel bans? Of course not. They're just going to pin it all on Donald Trump. It's so easy and it's so predictable. Listen to what the doctor at CNN, Sanjay Gupta, what he had to say about how that the President Trump administration early on didn't have enough testing out there for COVID-19. This is clip one.
There was a strategic, I think, method to minimizing this by not testing. Sad to say, but I think that's the truth now. I mean, you sort of suggested that early on, and I thought maybe we're just behind. But I think it was deliberate now at this point to not test because it would make things look bad.
That's him speculating that the Trump administration deliberately did not test early on because it would look bad. And he offers not one shred of evidence. And furthermore, if you look at the number of tests today, 60 million people in the United States have been tested. That's about a sixth of the population. That's twice as many as have been tested in all of Europe. 60 million people have been tested. And there's the doctor, the resident doctor at CNN, saying it was strategic. They didn't test Americans early. That's why it spread. That's why we had so many infections later. That's why we had so many deaths. And the United States has tested more than any other nation. Well, I guess China claims more, but you can't really believe those statistics. Not one bit of evidence. That's the evening news at CNN. All things Trump. Going back to the Atlantic here, it says few countries have been as severely hit as the United States. And again, if you look at the deaths per million, you're not going to get that context here at the Atlantic, though. It says, which has just 4% of the world's population, but a quarter of its confirmed COVID-19 cases and deaths. These are estimates. The actual toll, though undoubtedly higher, is unknown because the richest country in the world still lacks sufficient testing to accurately count its sick citizens. They haven't tested enough. I suppose they'd keep saying this even if we've tested all 327 million people. 60 million people. That's astounding. That number. Further on, it says this. This is the Atlantic. Of the 3.1 million Americans who cannot afford health insurance, just try to wrap your mind around this paragraph if you can. Of the 3.1 million Americans who cannot afford health insurance, more than half are people of color and 30% are black. This is no accident. In the decades after the Civil War, the white leaders of former slave states deliberately withheld health care from black Americans, apportioning medicine more according to the logic of Jim Crow than Hippocrates. They built hospitals away from black communities, segregated black patients into separate wings, and blocked black students from medical school. It says in the 20, well, it just continued. This is a 1619 disciple, obviously. Everything is related to race. And if you can believe it, it actually goes on and suggests that Donald Trump is not so unhappy about the deaths, the coronavirus deaths, certainly not with respect to the number of minorities, because he doesn't like black people, you see. This is the Atlantic. You totally lose perspective or blot out the history, blot out the bigger picture, like in the case of the police incident, as I covered at the start, or with other diseases that are spreading, other problems that are worsening because of the reaction to COVID-19. This is just one of the craziest articles we've seen yet that have sprung from the Trump derangement syndrome that we see in the media today. Well, if you step back and look at some of the facts with respect to COVID-19, the second wave, even though the peak deaths at this second wave, and it's not as bad as the first one, so there is some positive news to take away from what's happened just in recent weeks. But by every other measurement, whether you're looking at hospitalizations or the positive cases that are being tested, the peak appears to be behind us. And the deaths, the peak for deaths is probably going to be in the next week or so. So what will the media do then? How will they manipulate this story then? How will they frame? How will they adjust the framing or move the goalpost then? We'll see. But if we're just looking at the facts, going back to the worst of it in the middle of April, peak hospitalizations, that was April 15th with about 60,000. Peak daily deaths, 2,500. I think the highest was on May 7th, 2,740. And so in the midst of this second wave, I think the peak deaths that we've seen thus far is 1,400. And there have been more cases reported, but like President Trump keeps pointing out over and again, that's because there have been so many more tests done in the United States. Yes, in the United States, 60 million of them. Here's President Trump yesterday just talking about some of the positive signs that his team has seen here in the last few days. Clip three.
We're beginning to see evidence of significant progress. Nationwide, the number of positive cases has declined by nearly 6% from the week before, and the positive test rate has also dropped from 8.7 to 8% over that same period of time, an encouraging sign, very encouraging, I have to add, that the virus is receding. In hotspots across the South and West, we've seen slow improvements. From their recent weekly peaks, Arizona's weekly case counts have dropped 37% That's a tremendous drop. And the governor and the state have done a fantastic job. Down 37%. Texas down 18.7%. I was there a couple of days ago. And Florida, 21.2% drop. So that's a tremendous job that they're all doing.
That's the president yesterday reporting some positive news here as we hopefully, even for the work's sake, see a light at the end of the tunnel. But we'll wait and see, as I say, how the media will adjust the goalposts in the next week or two. One last item here before we go off for a break. Yesterday on the show, I talked about how Dr. Fauci drew a distinction between the crowds that, as he said, spreads the coronavirus, and of course the protests, which he actually supports. And so he was not going to criticize those protesters. Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, he was asked yesterday about the double standard. His administration has prevented certain more conservative movements from painting murals and things of that nature unless they get proper, I guess, putting in the application with the city government. And he's turned some of those down and has gotten criticized for them. And a reporter asked him yesterday, what about the Black Lives Matter mural that you painted out on Fifth Avenue? And as it turns out, he didn't even get proper authorization for that. He was out there with them, remember, painting with them. And they didn't get the city council's approval to do it. They just went and did it. And here's Mayor de Blasio explaining his reasoning for this obvious double standard just yesterday. Clip 4.
We haven't said no to people. We've said if you want to apply, you can apply, but there's a process. Look, the fact is that what I decided to do with the Black Lives Matter murals, and this came out of a meeting at Gracie Mansion weeks ago with community leaders and activists who said this would be such an important thing for this city to declare officially. That is something, again, transcends all normal realities because we are in a moment of history where this had to be said and done. That's a decision I made. But the normal process continues for anyone who wants to apply.
In other words, anyone else has to go through the normal process and apply for a permit to be able to paint up the street. Remember the two people that were just applying some chalk to the sidewalk, they actually had the permit to stage the protest, but I guess they didn't get the permit to draw on the sidewalk. So as we showed you yesterday, these two were arrested. And here's de Blasio in New York saying, if you want to paint up anything, of course you've got to go through the process. Now, for us, it's different. For us, it's different because what we're doing transcends all normal realities, don't you know? What we are a law unto ourselves. What he's talking about there is will worship. Look, you're just going to go along with I'm the mayor of this city. This was a moment, he said, a moment in history where it just had to be done. And so here are the Black Lives Matter movement, Antifa, all of them. They're enjoying the protection that the First Amendment provides. Free speech, freedom of assembly. They can do whatever they want, even to the point of destroying cities. And everyone else? Everyone else that would like to just get together for a peaceful religious gathering, for example, or maybe write some chalk on the sidewalk, they've got to go through the process. They might have to be arrested. I want to read to you what my father wrote in his recent Trumpet article, A Dangerous New Age in Will Worship, or Worshiping the Will. It says, Paul reveals, he's talking about Colossians 2 here, what happens when you worship the human will. It leads to, essentially, worshiping demons. That's because the human mind is so vulnerable to Satan's broadcasting deception and influence, especially when full of vanity. Following a human will really means following Satan's will. So when you have a leader, an individual in government, in a powerful position, when he gets up in his vanity and says, look, this is different. What I'm doing is different. What I did, that transcends all normal realities. This was a moment. It had to be done. It had to be said. And so he did it. He just did it. And those protesters in Portland, they're arguing from the same position, the same logic. Well, I don't even know if you can call it logic, but they're justifying their destruction of the city with that, well, this transcends normal realities. We just have to do it. We have to do it for justice, right? There was one police officer in Portland. He was quoted as saying that the demonstrators in that city are mentally ill, frothing at the mouth individuals who almost seem catatonic with hate. You can look up the word catatonic in the dictionary. It means abnormality of movement and behavior arising from disturbed mental state. This is one police officer's observation, saying that these protesters are frothing at the mouth with hate. We've seen some clips that we can't even play for you because every other word is profanity. But they're in the faces of officers just screaming at them. Every kind of obscenity. This officer, by the way, he said he's witnessed several instances where white protesters, if you can even call them protesters, they go right up to black police officers, screaming at them, cursing at them, even calling them the N-word. This is all about justice, right? It has to be done. That's what the good mayor says. Why, this is a moment in history. What did Barack Obama say last week? The problem, he said, the problem was the police, law enforcement. That's not the problem. The problem is lawlessness and this spirit being behind it all. John 8 and verse 44. Our father, the devil, that's what Jesus said of the Pharisees. You're of your father, the devil. He was a murderer from the beginning. And he abode not in the truth. There's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. That's the God of this world. That's the God that will soon be removed at the return of Jesus Christ. We can thank God for his plan of salvation and for the fact that Jesus Christ's return to this earth is imminent. When we come back, we'll finish our study. We'll finish the program, as I said at the start, on a very positive note, concluding that study on Theodore Roosevelt. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. from the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Yesterday in our study of Theodore Roosevelt, we talked about him being a man of action. We had that quote from Edmund Morris's biography about him being in the fellowship of doers. He was in the fellowship of doers. Well, building on that point, we could also say that Roosevelt was in the fellowship of positivity and joy. He really was a positive person. He really was a happy individual. This is from Edmund Morris's biography. It seems perfectly wonderful. Actually, this is quoting Theodore Roosevelt. He's writing to his sister. And he says, it seems perfectly wonderful looking back over my, well, I won't say how many years of existence. I'll give that to you in just a second. It says, to see how I have literally never spent an unhappy day unless by my own fault. When I think of this, and also of my intimacy with you all, the family that is, for I hardly know a boy who is on as intimate and affectionate terms with his family as I am, I feel I have an immense amount to be thankful for. I have so much to be thankful for. He wrote that to his sister when he was 18 years of age. He wrote that when he was a teenager. I read this to the campers a couple weeks ago and said, you know, we don't have any excuse to complain. Given the blessings that our nation has received from God, the comforts and the conveniences that we enjoy, the ease with which we can travel around the globe, the friends, the family, the fellowship that we have in God's work. This was someone who, he was a real doer, and it says something about being a doer and leading a productive life and applying yourself to your education. It makes you happy. God meant for us to produce. He's a creator. Jesus Christ is a creator. They are good workmen. And they're training us to be the same way. Later on in life, this was an observation that Morris made about Roosevelt's career, his stint as president in particular. It says, no chief executive certainly has ever had so much fun. He indeed delights in every aspect of his job. No president has ever had that much fun. You wonder how much he would have been able to hold up if he came under attack like the current president does. And it's, for that matter, it's pretty remarkable that Donald Trump is able to put a smile on anything, considering what he's going up against. But to just stay on this study, here was an individual who loved his job, who loved producing, who loved working, who loved being a doer, and it showed. Now, you look at an example in the Bible, Jesus Christ. You talk about someone who was facing resistance, persecution, one obstacle after another, one trial and test, even hours before the trial of his life. You can see this in John 15. He said to his disciples, at that final Passover, he said, if you keep my commandments, you shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. It says, these things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you and that your joy might be full. He was giving them this instruction just 18 hours or so before he suffered through that indescribable agony. And he was telling his disciples how to be filled with love, how to be filled with joy. If you look at that real Lord's Prayer in John 17, you see how much Jesus was even praying for his disciples. Again, within hours of his crucifixion, his horrific scourging, the next day he went out and, well, even when he was on the stake, he asked for God to have mercy on his persecutors. They didn't know what they were doing. He made arrangements for his mother to be taken care of after her, or after his death, I should say. He's doing all of this, even during his final agony and suffering. Jesus Christ, he practiced the way of give, even up until the very last moment. And Acts 20 and verse 35 says it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's more blessed to sacrifice than to be selfish. He gave us that as an example. He gave us that to follow in his steps. 1 Peter 2. Here in John 16, this is the final night that Christ had with his disciples. In verse 23, it says, "And in that day you shall ask me nothing. Verily, verily, I say unto you, whatsoever you shall ask the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Hitherto have you asked nothing in my name. Ask and you shall receive, that your joy may be full." He wanted their joy to be full. Even in the midst of a fiery trial, it is possible to be joyous and positive. It is possible to be a fellowship of positivity, or within the fellowship of positivity and joy. This is from the Tomorrow's World magazine back in 1971, speaking of Jesus Christ and how he was filled with joy even during his most difficult trial. It says, "Christ was filled with joy, even though he at the same time was a man of sorrows. And why? Because he loved all human beings, and he saw the way they were going. He saw how they were destroying themselves, how they were bringing unhappiness and emptiness, fear and worry, poverty, sickness, disease, and sufferings on themselves. He thereby shared their sufferings." Now, this is a depth of God's love that even in God's church, it's a challenge for us to be filled with this kind of love, to share in the sufferings of this world, the sufferings of the people we see so with such faces of anguish and pain and anger and hatred. We've brought this on ourselves, but can we share in the sufferings that we see all over the earth today? It says in this article, "Christ was a man of sorrows. He was sorrowful for them, but he was a man who was happy inside. He was setting us an example of the kind of life that we should live." It's possible to be happy and joyous. It's possible to be positive, even when in the midst of a fiery trial. The way to do it is to love others, to love other people. If we can't do that, we're never going to really be happy. We're never going to be content. We're never going to be positive. If the focus is solely on ourselves, we're just going to end up miserable. Going back to Theodore Roosevelt, though, for him as an 18-year-old boy, here he's looking back over his 18 years, and he says, "I have literally never spent an unhappy day unless by my own fault." That's a good perspective. That's pretty humble for the most part, for someone to say, if I've been unhappy, it's my fault. It's not someone else's fault. You're not going to hear that today from your typical 18-year-old. That's a unique example. That's some positive history that our young people today would do well to study. He fellowshipped among those who are positive and joyous. He dwelt within the fellowship of doers. He dwelt within the fellowship of family. As I touched on just at the end of yesterday's show, let me take you back to President Trump's Mount Rushmore speech, the one that I used so many clips from during the SEP camp. This was what President Trump had to say about Theodore Roosevelt as president. This is clip 5.
"Theodore Roosevelt exemplified the unbridled confidence of our national culture and identity. He saw the towering grandeur of America's mission in the world, and he pursued it with overwhelming energy and zeal. As a lieutenant colonel during the Spanish-American War, he led the famous Rough Riders to defeat the enemy at San Juan Hill. He cleaned up corruption as police commissioner of New York City, then served as the governor of New York, vice president, and at 42 years old, became the youngest ever president of the United States. He sent our great new naval fleet around the globe to announce America's arrival as a world power. He gave us many of our national parks, including the Grand Canyon. He oversaw the construction of the awe-inspiring Panama Canal. And he is the only person ever awarded both the Nobel Peace Prize and the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was American freedom personified in full. The American people will never relinquish the bold, beautiful, and untamed spirit of Theodore Roosevelt.
That's a clip from President Trump over the July 4th weekend, I guess about a month ago now. There he is praising that man who's enshrined on that monument there at Mount Rushmore. I mentioned the Edmund Morris biography the last few programs. That's one. Certainly, if you're interested in a good book about his younger years and what prepared him for that presidency, that would be a good biography to go through. I got a clip, or rather an email, coming in from one of our listeners who said, "My son and I are reading this book, the Edmund Morris biography. Thanks for that." And then another one, it says, "Thank you for bringing out the life and the history of Teddy Roosevelt. Students today are bored senseless, being forced to listen to feminist and racial grievances history. They are missing out on so much that is exciting and inspiring." Well, the students at the summer educational program, or the campers there, they were able to get a bit of that inspiring and exciting history. And speaking of the SEP program, I guess we probably have a time for a quick promo. We'll go to a quick promo and come back and conclude today's show with one of the segments produced by our campers during the broadcasting class at SEP. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
All right, we thank you for joining us on today's program. We're going to finish the show with a segment produced by one of our campers at the recent SEP program. This is Aiden McCarty. He produced this video segment on the cycling program at SEP. Take it away, Aiden.
Hello, my name is Aiden McCarty, and I am a camper here at SEP, and today I am at cycling. This year, our cycling instructor has been teaching us the fundamentals of cycling, which are body mechanics, which is the way that your body moves on the bike, and the bike's mechanics, which is the way that all the parts in the bike work together to accomplish what you want the bike to do. I am now here with the cycling instructor, Mr. Elias Noe. He is a student of Armstrong College, and he is going into his junior year. And I'm going to ask him a few questions about cycling and the cycling program. What are your main goals for your students or campers to achieve here at Cycling?
The goal I really want to achieve with the campers here is just to make them so they can have their really good stability, really good speed, so they can hit terrain that's pretty rough, maybe heavy traffic, because that requires real skill and you need good technique for that. So that's what I really want to get across to all the campers here at SEP.
How has the name SEP Summer Educational Program impacted the way that you teach cycling?
And I've sort of taken the idea of the Summer Educational Program and just thought, let's just educate these campers on all these skills, all these techniques, try and make it as simple as possible so they can go out there in the class and implement them practically so they can remember them when they go home. You know, not just say, get on a bike, let's go through some witches, some pylons and see how you go. I'll actually teach them how they should go around those pylons, or, you know, how do you go up a hill, go down a hill, how you should make a corner, where you should place your weight, all that sort of stuff. Because when you do that, that's when you can become really effective on the bike.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Noe. This is Aidan McCarty, and you have been at Cycling with us today.